I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 2nd of October. John Dean is our guest this hour, former counsel to President Richard Nixon from July of 1970 to April of 1973. He's going to be presenting the Robert W. Kastenmeier Lecture. The title of the lecture is Crossing the Line, Watergate, the Criminal Law, and Ethics. He presents this for the University of Wisconsin Law School this Friday at 4 o'clock, and the public is invited. It is free. We'll tell you more about that as the hour progresses. Dean, before becoming counsel to the president in 1970, was chief minority counsel to the House Committee on the Judiciary, an associate director of a law reform commission, and associate deputy in the Office of the Attorney General. He was Nixon's White House lawyer for 1,000 days, and he's a pretty important figure in American history. He's the author of a number of books, including Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, The Rehnquist Choice, The Untold Story of the Nixon Appointment, The Redefined Supreme Court, Pure Goldwater with Barry Goldwater Jr., and a number of other books. And I understand he is working right now on his 12th book, which again visits the subject of Watergate. He does a great deal of speaking and lecturing all over the country. And we're going to not only talk about Watergate, but I've been following his Twitter page during the past couple days, and he's had a lot to say about the government shutdown, so we'll talk to him about that as well. For you to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to leave messages there, please feel free to do so. It is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, John Dean.
Hi, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Nice to visit again.
Very nice to talk to you again. I've talked to you many times over the years. And before we get to Watergate, what's going on in Washington is truly incredible. And I noticed on your Twitter feed, I think yesterday, you were in agreement with Charles Pierce, who's a heck of a columnist, a strong political point of view. But he was writing about this Congress that has never been one before, that is a more lethal combination of political ambition, political stupidity, and political vainglory than exists in this Congress. You agree with that?
Well, I that's why I tweeted his Reign of the Morons
right
piece. The title caught my attention first. He makes an awful lot of sense. I'm actually working as we talk. I have to do a column for Friday, so since I'll be coming up to Madison, I thought I better get it out this morning. I thought, what better topic than the shutdown? So I'm at the keyboard as we speak, and to me, what's striking is clearly it is patently unconstitutional. It is also unconscionable. It is a violation of the congressional oath of office. It's unethical under their rules of ethics, but sadly, there's no legal remedy to deal with it.
Hmm.
But there is a way to handle it, and that calls for the voters to step up and do something about it.
How did it reach this point? It's hard to understand what all is at play. Is that there are a lot of members of the House who are worried about losing their seats because they've been targeted by very conservative organizations. They're going to spend a whole lot of money on television ads to support opponents who might be more conservative than they are? Is it more than that? Is it that part
of it? I think there's a conflation of a number of things. First of all, it's dominated by Southerners. We're reaping the problems of Nixon's Southern strategy, where he went into the South for votes, and the South came back and literally took over the Republican Party. And they are not behaving unlike they did when they were Democrats. They're politicians, where they invoked things like you know, resistance to all the civil rights laws, and their refusal to comply with anything that they thought didn't jive with their philosophy. So there's that. There's also been a concerted effort quietly going on for a number of years since the census to reapportion or gerrymander mm-hmm. states that will give a number of Republicans safe seats, where they're not really worried about losing. All they have to do is have Republican on their name, and they if they win a primary, they're pretty safe to get that seat. So that's been going on. That comes into play. Then I also think that I did actually a book on called Conservatives Without Conscience, where I tried to understand how some of the conservatives could act like they do. And I didn't do it to point fingers as much as just to understand why it was going on. And there are clearly authoritarian personalities that dominate the ranks of the conservative movement today. This doesn't mean that they're all Nazis. It means that they are often just personalities that like to follow strong leaders. And when that leader, whatever that leader says, they salute, click their heels, and say, yes, indeed, let's do it that way. And that's going on. So all these things have kind of come together with the Tea Party movement really being the label that these people like to carry to distinguish themselves. And a number of them have run on a platform of shutting down the government. So they actually feel they're accomplishing their goal with this absolutely crazy behavior.
So what in the world is the way forward?
Well, I think a number of things will have to happen. First, I'm delighted to see the Beltway media not going pox on everybody's house this time, because it really isn't pox on everybody's house. It is driven by the Republicans at this point. And they've got that. And they've got that because the media understands that while the shutdown is troublesome, even more troublesome comes the debt ceiling limit we hit around October 17th. Mm-hmm. And this is obviously is going to roll and play right into that. So the media is very aware that when you're playing with that, you're really playing with nuclear material that could have a chain reaction, not only on our economy, but the world's economy. So how do you get out of it? Maybe one of the things that happens is Americans' creditors just say, hey, this is an unstable economy, and they start selling bonds. That's how we fund our operations. That will have very serious consequences if that happens. The other thing, hopefully we don't get there. Hopefully the thing stabilizes long before it gets there. And I'm hopeful that President Obama, who it's not his style to be a highly active and vocal in his partisan criticism, but I've never seen a more opportune time for him to do so. I was thinking about how Bill Clinton performed when he was president during that shutdown, and he was like a caged animal. You know, he was vocal. He absolutely manhandled Newt Gingrich when they had to negotiate. I think we need a little of that kind of energy to raise the issue. But I don't know if common sense will prevail or not, and it's certainly ultimately up to the American voters. I'm surprised, for example, that the Department of Justice under Holder has not been more aggressive in going after the gerrymandered congressional districts. This has been a problem that's been apparent for a number of years. 2010 kind of rang the bell, and everybody knew that when the Republicans took over the Congress after Obama had only been in there 2 years, that there was something amiss, because more Americans certainly have voted Democratic than they have Republican. But the way the country is gerrymandered, Republicans have a disproportionate amount of power.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this small group of Republicans really believed that by their actions they were going to defund the Affordable Care Act?
Well, it's hard for me to understand how you could reach that belief. But I'm told by friends in Washington there are people there who actually believe they could force the president in. And they think it's more strongly the case with the debt ceiling, that he'll crumble on that. notwithstanding his protestations that he's not going to negotiate it, they believe that he'll crumble at the last minute in a game of chicken. And so they do believe it.
Mm-hmm. You wrote in one of your little pieces this week, and this is just mentioning one part of the government that has shut down. The FAA is furloughing thousands of airline safety inspectors, not something you want to hear. I think about all of those World War II vets yesterday who charged the fence and just went in and saw that. Maybe everybody needs to do that. We're just going to charge the fence and go into the National Archives or to the Smithsonian or to the Lincoln Monument. We're just going to take matters into our own hands. You wonder at what point are the American people going to say, wait a second, you just can't keep doing this. This is our government, too.
Well, you know, furloughing safety inspectors is troublesome for me. I'm about to get on an airplane.
Right.
So I'd like to have those inspectors keeping an eye. But obviously it calls for extra diligence by the airlines during a time like this to make sure that nothing does happen. And you know, you can't blame those vets who came there in wheelchairs or on crutches and what have you,
right,
to see the memorial that is sort of a part of their immortality from the great generation's deeds that kept this country safe. So no one tried to block them. Once they opened the gate, they just were able to get in there. Maybe they're not enough employees since I think a lot of the law enforcement, federal law enforcement, and there are a number of law enforcement jurisdictions in Washington, from the Park Police to the D.C. Police to what have you. Maybe their ranks have been thinned by the lack of money as well.
Right. So tell me, let me ask a general question about what happens to people when they achieve positions of power. I mean, you've been through this in a fairly dramatic way with Watergate and with the whole Nixon administration. Does something happen? It seems to happen to everybody that they lose touch with how they got there, who the people were who sent them there. That there's something about the power, there's something about thinking you can deceive people that just wasn't just a part of the Nixon administration. It seems to happen again and again that the voices that you listen to are those who surround you, who have to, you owe your job to them in some ways, and you lose touch with what's good and what's honest and what's true. What the heck happens?
Well, you know, I don't think necessarily obtaining a position of power causes somebody to lose touch. Certainly at a middle level staffer, as a White House counsel would be, you're still pretty much in touch with reality. You do get something of a bunker mentality when they're firing at you, if you will, because you believe, you know, that. For example, I believed at the time I was working at the Nixon White House that Nixon had good intentions, that indeed he wanted to end the war honorably in Vietnam as quickly as he could. It's only been really I was slow to meet Richard Nixon. I'm there almost a couple years before I really figure out who this guy is, and I'll ultimately break rank. I'm going through a drill right now of, had I known, I probably wouldn't have taken it on. It's one of the reasons I'm back out lecturing on Watergate, because my publisher convinced me for the 40th anniversary of Watergate to get back into this subject.
Mm.
Some questions I wanted the answers to, so I figured either through Stanley Cutler from Madison's, Wisconsin's work on freeing the Nixon tapes from the National Archives in his collection, or from the Watergate prosecutor, I'd find the answers in those roughly 400 conversations. But then I discovered nobody had ever really cataloged all of the Watergate conversations, and there are almost 900, just under 1,000, 997. And so I've had a team of graduate students the last 4 years transcribing everything. We've redone, for example, Stanley Cutler's are really just partial transcripts, and he apparently did not keep his drafts once he published. At least he couldn't find them for me when I asked for them, and the Watergate prosecutors, they're most of the 80 transcripts they prepared are just first drafts, and they're not very good. Most of them were done by FBI secretaries who really didn't even know who the players were. Mm-hmm. So we just started from scratch and have done them all. We're on the home stretch now. But the drill of going through all these tapes and listening to the hundreds of hours I have of Nixon now, I really have discovered who he is. And I think he did lose touch, to come back to your question, that once he took on the mantle of that office, he took on an arrogance that he felt indeed that it was, he could almost speak ex cathedra and make decisions that he didn't give a damn whether the Congress opposed or what have you, or the courts. But I don't think that necessarily permeated his whole staff. It certainly didn't me, and I know a lot of others it did not. But so I think power affects different people different ways.
Mm-hmm.
For Henry Kissinger, it was an aphrodisiac.
Right. Right, Henry Kissinger, he got a lot of women to enjoy Henry Kissinger, didn't he? I was watching a CBS thing recently, and they were talking, and I guess it's somebody who you are on tour with occasionally, a Nixon historian who said that perhaps, and I'm wondering if you have found this through listening to conversations or being in the thick of this, do we know what happened to that 18 and a half minutes now?
Well, we do and we don't. Jim Robinault, who I do as a result of this drill of going through all these tapes and getting back into Watergate to try to answer some of the unanswered questions and really piece together. That prompted me to call Jim, and we do a CLE, a continuing legal education for lawyers. And we thought we'd just do it a couple times. We did it a couple times in Chicago, and we did it for, thought we just, you know, kind of play with it. He is a Watergate buff, and so we did it, and the thing caught on, and we've done about 95 to 100 of them.
Whoa.
We've lost count of you know, and it, but for the fact I had a book to do, I could book all the way out almost daily to here to the end of the year. October, I've got, you know, like we cut it way back, but I'm out 19 days in October away from my keyboard, which is risky at this point because I got a manuscript due in January.
Right.
But anyway, he was on CBS, and what prompted him to do that, he was on there with a fellow by the name of Phil Houston, and Phil is a former CIA expert at discerning deception. And Jim sent Phil a copy of Nixon's testimony on before the grand jury after he'd left office about the about the 18 and a half minute gap to see what Phil's reaction to it was. Well, Phil has a system that humans are not able to deceive others when they are doing so. Different triggers happen and different kind of behavioral traits come up. Hmm. And he read Nixon's testimony and he said, you know, if I'd have known about this when I did a book on this, this rings every bell in my system.
Oh.
I mean, this is highly deceptive. So that started Jim, who turned to me first and said, listen, now you're the only one I know who's transcribed all these tapes to know what could have been in his knowledge base. And so we figured out, you know, what was it that would cause him to erase anything? Because it clearly indicates, Jim also got it down to who had access to the machine. Plus the fact, they talking to an expert, as it comes up in that CBS clip, that Rose Woods could not have done it on the machine she had.
Mm-hmm.
It was not and the way she said it was done, it just not the an expert said there's just no way that you could do it with a foot pedal or with a one hand reaching over and turning the machine off. The machine was designed to require pushing two buttons simultaneously and was not easy to do. You had to, in fact, most, they designed them so difficult that most women had to almost stand up and leverage because they didn't have enough hand strength.
Hmm.
So this left it down to just a hand, two or three people, including Richard Nixon, who had Al Haig and one of Al Haig's, two of his aides had access to the tapes at that period of time. And so when you look at what was, first of all, what was erased becomes pretty simple. By the time they're erasing, Nixon has formed his firewall defense that the only thing that, he says he knew about Watergate and the cover-up was what I had told him on March 21st when I gave him the so-called cancer on the presidency talk to try to get him to end the cover-up. He says that's all he, you know, he that became his defense. He hung on that. Well, as the smoking gun later showed, when that was surfaced, he clearly knew there was a cover-up within days when he orders the CIA to go to the FBI to stop the FBI investigation into Watergate. That's clear cover-up. But that tape was not didn't surface until very late because of the Supreme Court fight and all that business.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is on the 20th, where the gap appears, which was one of the first tapes that was subpoenaed, it's clear that he has knowledge there's a cover-up at that point. So he obviously said something to Haldeman in that conversation that was evidence of a cover-up. And it doesn't. He knew that Liddy was responsible. He not the sort of thing where they played it. Well, he must have been ordered the Watergate break-in. No evidence of that in any of these conversations. And there are times he's clearly forgets he's being recorded. When you listen to the, when you go through 997 conversations,
goodness.
Yeah, I've gotten pretty familiar with what he did know and what he did know, didn't know. And so, but what's obvious is that he did know that first week, and by the 20th, which is 3 days after the arrest, that there was a cover-up. The cover-up goes in place literally the weekend of the arrest. I happened to be out of the country, and it was clearly in place when I came into the office 2 days later. So 3 days later, when Nixon is back in Washington and his tape machine is running, he knows there's a cover-up, and so all he had to do is say something that would have tipped that off, and it would have blown away his defense with the very first subpoena for conversations, where there were six of my conversations and this one with Haldeman on the 20th, where the gap appears. So this is what obviously was erased, and the odds are, given Nixon's behavior, really remarkable behavior in his grand jury testimony, is what Jim is saying is, you know, he makes himself the prime candidate.
Hmm. John Dean is our guest this hour. He's going to be in Madison this coming Friday. He's going to be giving a lecture, and it is the Robert W. Kastenmeier Lecture titled Crossing the Line, Watergate, the Criminal Law, and Ethics. It's for the University of Wisconsin Law School. It's at the Gordon Dining and Event Center on Dayton Street, for those of you who are keen to attend, and I'm sure many of you would be. He, of course, for those of you who may not remember this chapter in history, but I can't believe we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of this already. You'll hear a lot more about Watergate. He played a key role in disclosing all that was happening. He testified for some 7 hours, absolutely riveting testimony. Former counsel to the President of the United States from July of 1970 to April of 1973, and he is the author of many, many books. He's written he's on his 12th book now. You heard him say going through 1,000 conversations, all of those tapes, and listening to all of them. So he is with us this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We also started the hour by talking about what's going on in Washington right now and how we find a way forward. heard, so feel free to address your comments in those areas as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Dean is our guest this hour. We go to phone calls now at 800-486-8655, starting with Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Oh, thanks, Kathleen. Mr. Dean, I have a quick question. When people elected Richard Dixon, they kind of knew who he was as a person and his ethics. The same I would wonder about looking at some of our other presidents, from Ronald Reagan with Iran-Contra, from George W. Bush with the Scooter Libby / Valerie Plame episode. And I also look at like a Barack Obama with Lois Lerner and the IRS scandal in Benghazi. Don't we kind of want to elect someone who's going to do the things we think need to be done, but personally we can't ethically bring ourselves to do? Thanks.
Well, I've never looked at it that way. First of all, I'm not sure we really do know very well who we elect. Campaigns are so highly staged. When I got to know the private Nixon, he was much different than the public Nixon. In fact, my image of him, until I really started having one-on-one dealings with him, was very different, and I slowly realized who he was. Now, yeah, of course, he had the reputation of being a rough political fighter and a dirty fighter and things like that in campaigns. But I thought there was a real moral core there, that there were certain things he wouldn't do. Today I suspect there's nothing he wouldn't have done. I think that we make sort of visceral judgments of people that may or may not be right. And our presidents are so packaged today in a campaign, it's really hard to know who they are. Hmm. So I can't take the premise of your question.
So who was Richard Nixon?
A very complex man. In many ways, fascinating. Because of his complexity. Kissinger once said if somebody would have just hugged him when he was little, what a different person he might have been. But let me just say this. In listening to the tapes, theoretically all of the personal material has been removed, but occasionally the archives didn't do that for whatever reason. And I've heard Nixon talk to his daughters, for example, and it's a lovely father-daughter relationship. I heard there's a conversation where he talks to his wife, Pat, right after he thinks he's got a peace in Vietnam. And that's one of the first persons he calls after he talks to Kissinger. And it's a lovely relationship. I'm sure they must have been shocked to hear some of the things that are on those tapes. He is also noticeably a different person with different members of the staff. He, for example, with Ray Price, he's very high level. With me, he plays it at a very high level. And then he talks about those high-minded lawyers behind their back. He's different. He's something of a chameleon with the personality he has in front of him. He takes his read on that personality and then plays to that personality, which is kind of unique. So he's different people to different staffers, and we have this remarkable record in these recordings where people will get to know him and who he was, and it's not a very pretty picture.
No. And when you say, John Dean, there was nothing he wouldn't do, what do you mean?
Well, I just was reading the New York Times Review of Books, book review section last Sunday, and I was seeing this new book out called the Blood Memo or Blood Telegram, we're one of the two, and it's about Pakistan the fact that he and Kissinger just permitted something like 300,000 people to be slaughtered using American equipment and feeding a dictator who was doing this. It's just really quite striking. It bordered on genocide, apparently. This was found, their attitude was surfaced in some of these tapes. I haven't read the book yet. I've ordered it just out of curiosity. But I see, in just the Watergate tapes, he is ruthless. And his first reactions are exactly what the opposite I would have thought them to be to different things. But that's what it takes. My big problem is I have so much material. It is boiling it down, and I do it in a way where they're not transcripts, but rather I take dialogue out of the transcripts and then narrative out of the rest. And that's why it's been a very difficult book to, first of all, get the transcript prepared, and now digesting them, boiling them down.
Oh, my goodness. I imagine that's an immense amount of material.
You wouldn't believe. I just did April, and it's, let's see, 2, 4, 6 volumes.
Oh.
Thick, like 4-inch volumes of binders. That's just for April of 1973.
Ooh. Binders.
But I've been going through it. I've been there.
Thank you, Charlie, very much for the call. Ronaldo in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yes, Mr. Dean. I'm curious. How long was Mr. Hunt from the CIA associated with Nixon? Was it the first term or just the second term? And also my second question, sir, if you don't mind, how do you feel about the press covering the president, this particular president, compared to Nixon? Do you think it's biased? Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Ronaldo.
I think your first question was, how old was Howard Hunt when he joined Nixon?
Right.
He had retired from the CIA. I think he took an early retirement, so he was probably in his early 60s after an 18 to 20-year career within the CIA. And it happens during late in the first term. It happens about the time the Pentagon Papers are released in 1971 is when Colson recruits him and they bring him on. And Liddy comes on shortly thereafter, and it's this duo that creates the nightmares. But I think that, certainly they should have known that these guys were capable of what they did, and it was deemed acceptable behavior to Nixon and the others at the time.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the second question on is the press bias, well, it's hard to talk collectively about the press. The press has become increasingly partisan. There are obviously Fox News has its view, NPR has its view, different CBS and ABC, and they all have different slants, and they are increasingly partisan. So I think that you really find a spectrum on the coverage of Obama. I think that there has. I think he was very exciting as a candidate, and there's a familiarity that grows within the press corps in Washington as a president and presidency goes on, and they get a little bit more candid and rough on often presidents later in their terms than they are earlier in their terms. So that is set in. And they're also just by nature harder on the White House and the president than they are in Congress. I've often been frustrated, I think right now when we're seeing this shutdown, that there should be more surfacing the clowns that are really responsible for this thing. And they're only slowly, the New York Times had a piece this morning about them, but only a few of them. And there's about 18 to 20 of these people who are really driving this thing. And on the other hand, there are about 18 to 20 moderate Republicans who may break rank at some point.
And why are the 18 to 20 kind of running the show here? Why doesn't Boehner exert more authority? Why don't those who would probably desire a straight vote on this clear vote? Where are all their voices? Why are these 18?
Apparently, they have enough power within the Tea Party movement that they can use that power to provoke getting even harder right candidates than other conservatives who are following them if they break rank. And to get a primary in the Republican Party is pretty much determines the election in these gerrymandered districts. So that saves them money, saves them time and effort if they don't have, a primary opponent. And it's the threat of using the primary process with even harder right candidates that really is the problem for these people and is being used to keep them in line.
Yeah. Here's an email to you from Cecilia in Manitowoc. Mr. Dean, at what point did you accept that your actions were illegal? And prior to that understanding, what did you tell yourself to make it okay to continue?
You know, I'm going to talk about that a good bit in the lecture about how how all the lawyers, including myself, got on the wrong side of the line. Just generally, I to this day, in fact, one of the drills that I've kind of gone through going through these tapes is to figure out when exactly did I get on the wrong side of the line, and it's the kind of activities and the kind of violations I was involved in, a conspiracy to obstruct justice, which is the only crime I know I committed. These are not bright line crimes. You know, if you commit perjury, it's when you lie. You know, if you break and enter, it's when you break and enter. You know, if you plant a bug, it's when you plant the bug. But when you obstruct justice, it's very vague. For example, it's not an obstruction of justice to obstruct the FBI. At least the time I was there. It's only when the grand jury gets involved or you're directly interfering with the grand jury's proceeding. But these are all kind of vague crimes, as most cover-up crimes are. So I pinpointing exactly when I violated the law is very difficult, and I'm not sure I can do it. Hmm. The other thing, though, I do know and understand how so many lawyers got involved, and that's one of the things I try to share as a result of my experience, and we'll be sharing with, delighted to be into a law school where we get some younger people, because I was very young at the time, in my early 30s as White House counsel, and you tend to take your cues from older people, and that's a mistake. But anyway, that's the subject of the session I'm going to have at the law school. I don't want to scoop myself.
Okay. John Dean is our guest this hour. He will be at the law school. Actually, it's this Friday at 4 o'clock. It's at the Gordon Dining and Event Center on Dayton Street, 4 o'clock. He'll be talking about crossing the line, Watergate, the criminal law, and ethics. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation with John Dean, the author of Blind Ambition in 1976, about his days in the Nixon White House, Lost Honor. He's writing and lecturing frequently now, and he's working on his 12th book, which is his huge undertaking, listening to at least 1,000 conversations in the Nixon White House, and then finding parts of those that are most important and analyzing all that. Can you imagine how much there is, all that's in those 1,000 conversations to give the narrative of his book? We'll ask him when it's coming out. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, if you'd like to go there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls for John Dean, 800-486-8655, our number, June in Shawano. Hello.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, June.
Hi, Mr. Dean. I was in Washington at the time all of this occurred that Mr. Dean is describing.
We know how old you are.
Working as a civil servant in the Office of Prices and Price Analysis, we were in the midst of rebasing the consumer and producer price indexes. And there was so much excitement in the office. People were going out to get new editions put out by the Washington Times, the evening paper then, and hadn't he resigned yet? They were just so excited. And the thing I remember most of this time was that all of this confusion at the top, the civil service did their work. They allowed the government to go on. And the thing that annoys me most about this current crisis is when they are letting 800,000 to 900,000 people go, that this work isn't being done. And these people are saying that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They don't do anything anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But they still would be doing the work.
John Dean.
Yeah, your point is well taken. There was no shutdown during Watergate. There was a fixation at the White House as time went on, where first it was a non-issue and it became the only issue. So, in fact, Watergate became so consuming that I'm told that, for example, when I was testifying, that 85% of all households and most offices had their television.
Oh, my goodness.
So they weren't getting much work during those days. But you're right. It's a different point on the shutdown. It is it's unconstitutional. There's just no justification for it. It is a form of extortion that is really a bizarre way to try to govern. If you can't persuade people to change the law, there is no authority in the Constitution to withhold funds from that law to try to change it. There's very little legal commentary on it, and there's unfortunately no remedy to go into the courts and deal with this because it's considered a political question. And the federal courts have been loath over their history to really get into political questions. You go back to the famous Marbury versus Madison case in 1803 when Chief Justice John Marshall first addressed this. That was a political question, but he adroitly got around it. So it's only on rare occasions that the court will go into political matters that they believe are really within the purview of the other branches. As recently, when I was doing the Goldwater book, he sued Carter over his treaty making. But the courts denied the senator standing because it was considered a political question. Nixon, of course, when he refused to turn over his tapes, raised the political question doctrine there, and a sufficient number of the court said, well, this also involves the power of our grand juries, therefore we're going to let the grand jury enforce its subpoena against even the President of the United States, that nobody is going to be above the law when it comes to a federal grand jury. So, anyway, there is no remedy to go in and stop the shutdown at this point other than the political remedy, which is people like yourself who are just outraged, calling a few more people and telling them to make sure we don't have irresponsible members of Congress when come around the next election.
Thanks, June, for the call. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering how Richard Nixon felt about you. Did he ever go out with you after this, or go out for dinner, and how did he feel about you?
Well, I talk about that in the book because I was surprised what I found on the tapes, and let's just say that he held me in maximum high esteem before I broke rank, and after I broke rank, in minimum high esteem. So I became his number one enemy.
He didn't go out for dinner.
He did not go out to dinner.
No.
In fact, he did not really go out to dinner ever with anybody. Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, once said to Mike Wallace that he didn't think that Nixon, notwithstanding all the years he worked for him, knew how many children he had or what gender they were. He had never shaken hands with Nixon in all the years he'd worked with him.
Hmm.
So this is a strange fellow.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jim, very much for the call. A caller couldn't stay on the line but wanted to get your opinion of Governor Scott Walker and his aspirations for the presidency.
Well, your governor is, to me, somewhat of a Nixonian character. He is interesting. He is serving only part of your state and ignoring the other part. He tends, like Nixon, to look for cresting issues that are highly controversial that he can get in front of, and he will ride it even though it hurts a lot of people. And for that reason, I find him a very Nixonian type character.
Do you think he has a chance at all?
No.
Okay.
Unless he goes somehow skews himself back to the center. No. I don't think there are enough votes for any of these Tea Party candidates to ever play on the national stage.
The other thing, getting back, I know in one of your lectures recently you were talking about the beginnings of Watergate, and I believe you said this, lest onlookers think the burglary at the Watergate offices of the DNC in June of 72 were carefully scripted. They weren't. You call the whole beginning here kind of a fishing expedition.
That's very true. And, you know, one of the things I'm doing an appendix to the book I'm doing where I've gleaned from the conversations everything that Nixon and Haldeman and Ehrlichman were able to pick up, as well as myself at the time, as to why they broke in. I think it's important to put that, some created into a mystery where it is really not. You know, Gordon Liddy thought he was sort of a James Bond character when, in fact, he wasn't really up to the Maxwell Smart level. And it's just bungling. And so people assume there's a lot more in sophistication in this whole undertaking than there actually was. It was just a bungled mess is what it was. And they're just in there looking around. We know what they were looking for because we know what the Cuban Americans were told to look for. And so I've pulled all that together hopefully if I can keep it, given the amount of words I'm already dealing with, 2,000 or 3,000 word essay appendix that'll explain what they were doing when they went in there.
Doug in La Crosse, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Doug. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank Mr. Dean for his book on Warren Harding. I think it's an excellent book, and it's not revisionist, but it certainly causes you to think the man anew. And then having introduced that topic, I'd be curious as to whether he sees any similarities between those two presidents, where one, as you mentioned, didn't even shake Haldeman's hands, and, of course, Warren Harding was the ultimate people person. And so I'd just be curious as to whether there is any similarities or because your guest is the one person who studied both.
Okay, we have about a minute, John Dean.
Right. Very, very different personalities. You've named it. In fact, I think that Nixon, because of China, will always be appreciated, whereas Warren Harding has been, to me, one of the most maligned presidents we've ever had, and he was much better than he was ever given credit for. When I did that book for Arthur Schlesinger, he said, you know, I don't like Harding. I don't think much of him. By the time he read my manuscript, he'd done 180 on him.
Interesting. Thank you very much for the call. So when's the book, when is it coming out? Next year? Early?
It'll be out next year for the 40th anniversary of Nixon's resignation.
40th year.
Isn't that incredible?
Gosh, it just zooms on by.
Must mean we're having fun.
I guess it does. I don't know how much fun we're having, but it goes fast. Thanks, John Dean, so much for being with us.
Nice chatting again.
John Dean, former counsel to President Richard Nixon. He's going to be presenting the Robert W. Kastenmeier Lecture. It's Crossing the Line, Watergate, the Criminal Law, and Ethics. Isn't that hard to believe? It's been 40 years next year since the Nixon resignation. Wow. At any rate, he's speaking at the Gordon Dining and Event Center on Dayton Street in Madison, Wisconsin at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I would imagine that it would be of great interest to many of our listeners. So if you're in the area, go see him. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program. Thanks for your calls, everybody, and for your emails and all of that. We have news coming up momentarily with the latest on day two of the government shutdown. And next, a story of politics and athletic competition and inspiration.